Welcome, everyone. We are here, another episode of the Spoolcast, International Edition, because I have from the Netherlands one of the smartest people I know, Stephen Hay. And Stephen, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here virtually.
Stephen will be presenting a day-long workshop at UX Immersion Mobile April 13th through 15th in Salt Lake City. For more information, visit uxim.co.
Virtually, across the ocean, the bits are moving.
You know I'm not from the Netherlands, right?
Well, I mean, but you are, in that when you come to the conference, you will be taking a plane from Amsterdam, I believe.
That is true. That is true.
So, you know, as much as anyone is from anywhere, the atoms in your body were all from the Big Bang. So, you know.
Right. Okay. Well, you got me. Touché.
Carl Sagan once said that if you want to make an apple pie from scratch, you have to start with a Big Bang. And so everything sort of comes back to that notion. The other related thing I heard the other day was about that big thing that they have in CERN. What's it called?
The Large Hadron Collider.
Yes. The thing I heard was that physicists have a tradition. Every 16 billion years, they get together and build a Large Hadron Collider.
Okay. That's like really deep, nerdy humor right there.
Yeah, I'm into deep, nerdy physics jokes today. I don't know why. It's just one of those things. But that's not what we came to talk about. What we came to talk about was workflow and sort of dealing with this. So I've been talking with a lot of teams lately, and they have been telling me that this move to responsive is not just about making things so that when you move your arm to the left and the right while holding the corner of the browser, everything just moves around nicely. It's changing the way they do everything. It has this impact. And, you know, people are like, we need to go responsive. Sure, we can have that done by next week. And then they realize it changes their world completely. Have you seen this?
No, not at all. I have no idea what you're talking about. Yes, I see this all the time. It's getting better very, very slowly, but it seems like everyone has kind of the same problems since we started doing responsive design. And I started doing responsive design before we really had a name for it. We were just making fluid grids. We didn't have media queries, you know, to completely change the layout. You know, if you're talking about layout, we didn't use media queries yet, but we were doing a lot of things in the direction of responsive design. And I guess that's when I noticed that the problems were starting for, you know, my work. And now I'm noticing the same stories. I try to sound like I'm hearing these painful stories for the first time. Every time I talk to them, oh, yeah, that sounds pretty painful. But really, they're all variations on the same kind of problem. And I think it's just the way organizations are set up. Especially the larger the organization, the bigger the problems that they seem to have with responsive. And I'm not sure why a lot of companies don't understand that that waterfall process is the problem, really. That I guess when we started specializing in the beginning, you know, when I first started doing websites, I did everything, right? I designed, I did wireframes, I did pretty much everything because you could back then. Things were simpler. And we started specializing. And once you start specializing, everyone starts getting their own deliverables, you know? It's like deliverables are the way to validate your value within a team. And when you do that, you have your own little deliverable. And as long as you do that and everyone's happy with that and you get sign off on that thing, then you pass it over to the next person. And they make their deliverable based on yours. And, you know, they get sign off on that and pass it to the next person. And then the problems that you will eventually have, because everyone does, design problems or development problems, you'll find them. You always do, but you're going to find out about them later on down the line. So that's one of the huge problems, is that we still push, with that whole waterfall effect, we start pushing a lot of the problem solving toward the end of the project when it becomes very expensive to do so. And it seems like everyone has some kind of version of that problem, the special areas of expertise not talking enough, not working enough together, you know, just worrying about their own little silo. And some of them are really nice about it to each other. But it's pretty much the problem of communication and collaboration, really. I tend to think that most problems with responsive design are not even really technical problems, because we have a lot of smart developers. Whenever I go into a company or into a team, they're incredibly smart people on almost every team. They're there for a reason most of the time. And the technical issues are pretty well documented, how to deal with images. You know, there are problems with them, but a lot of smart people trying to work around these problems. But the problems that no one really talks about are the ones within the organization. So the fact that, you know, you have to fly to Sweden to get sign-off on this Photoshop comp before, you know, the people in Germany start building this thing. You know what I mean? That type of problem is not the thing that people first think of when they think of all the problems they have with responsive design, because they don't trace it back to those types of situations. The fact that we start with visual design oftentimes, or interaction design even, before we even really think enough about the content. And people don't think about these things because it's not nice to think about them, because it does mean you have to change the way you look at things. I think a lot of people are willing to do that, but they see this huge wall, the organizational wall, like I have to get my manager to agree to doing it a new way, and he has to get his manager to, you know, grant him that. So that becomes a huge issue, especially in larger organizations. So
years ago, when I started doing consulting, a friend of mine handed me a book called The Secrets of Consulting by Gerald Weinberg. And he has a couple of laws of consulting. His first law of consulting is Weinberg's first law, he calls it. No matter how much your client insists to the contrary, there's always a problem. And the second law is, no matter how much your client insists to the contrary, it's almost always a people problem. And this responsive workflow thing, you know, you brought up a point I'd never thought of before, which was that when we're that solo web designer, webmaster, the only one in the shop doing that work, we don't work in a waterfall manner. We don't, you know, do the design for 8 weeks and write up a document. Then we then hand it off to ourselves and, you know,
right.
Start to
and
implement.
Then get mad at yourself
for not thinking it through and well, and then go back to ourselves for approval.
You get mad.
Yeah, probably. But that we work in this very sort of iterative, jumping around, ad hoc, crazy, drunken sailor's path, you know, type approach. And it's only when we've said, well, you're going to do this, and then you're going to give it to me, and I'm going to do that, that we suddenly put up this wall and say, hey, we can't have that sort of interactive back and forth. You know, you've got to do your thing, and I'll just sit here politely until you hand it to me.
Yes. And we might tell you what we're doing, but so many organizations don't. You know, are you suggesting we call this drunken sailor design?
Drunken sailor design.
Just to call up Ethan Marcotte and tell him we're changing the name.
Yeah.
Drunken sailor design. No, but it is true that I think it's a natural way to work. If you go and work alone on something and you have several overlapping disciplines within yourself, as we used to in the beginning of the web.
Yeah, we still do.
We still do. You do a lot of different things. I do a lot of different things. I think I saw a talk Jonathan Snook did recently about, I think he calls it deep generalists. And so being a generalist, but then having a couple of areas of expertise where you go pretty deep.
Oh, I'm a big fan of that. I think we spend too much time thinking about our roles and not enough time thinking about our skills. And that what we should be doing is just constantly assessing our skills. And, you know, maybe I'm not that great at visual design, but that doesn't mean I can't get better at visual design, right? I could hang around people who are awesome at visual design, and I could try stuff and I could have them critique it. And suddenly, you know, if I kept doing that, I would get better. Would I ever be as good as them? Probably not. But I could get better, because visual design, 99% of getting better at visual design is just practicing and just doing it. And taking the time and effort to do it. I think that we all have multiple disciplines of skills within us, and we constrain ourselves by saying, well, I'm just a programmer, so I'm not a designer, so I'm not going to do that design thing. I'm going to let the person who's a designer do it, but damn, if they start to code, I'm going to get really pissy about it. And you know, it's like, no, that's crazy, right? If everybody on the team can handle basic, simple coding, then putting a prototype together to get an idea out, that's like the simplest thing in the world now, because anyone in the team can handle it. And yeah, it's not going to be production level code. It's not going to be, you know, the best code ever written, but it's going to get the prototype out and someone's going to go, yeah, that's what I meant, or no, that's not what I wanted. And that's just powerful when everybody can do a little bit of everything. And then, you know, sure, there's stuff that they just have more experience and practice at. That's what I think Jonathan's talking about with that deep generalist stuff.
Yes, I think so. And it goes the other way as well. You know that one of the big debates about this workflow stuff, especially the way I talk about it, is I see code as a potentially powerful tool for designers. Not a lot of designers agree with that, and they're kind of afraid. You know, it's like you're taking me out of the creative zone, you know, and you're putting me into more of a developer zone. But so that's not really what we're saying at all, because the other way is just as valid. I don't want to be able to code myself necessarily, but I do want to understand what's going on when someone does code, and I want to understand more about what's possible with code in the same way that a print designer understands the process of printing without herself having to go and operate the press, understanding how the paper will react with the ink, you know, what effect will that have on the colors, visualizing what this thing will end up being like based on the knowledge of all this technical stuff, really, that a printer has to deal with. But really, I know a lot of designers, at least from, I guess, my age group, who have done that traditional graphic design even before we started using computers for putting everything together. I mean,
yeah, back when we still printed things.
Yes, exactly, when we actually printed things. And we would go in, and I remember, I'll never forget it, and people talk about it now, going into like a workshop, Eric Speakerman workshop on letterpress or something, you know, and using all those old, you know, the metal letters and typesetting things. It's interesting to be able to do that. And the fact that designers want to do that kind of thing, even though it's outdated and technical in a sense, they don't often share that same enthusiasm for learning code. And there are some beautiful things that are being done with code. I mean, a bunch of art is being done with code, and it's just beautiful. Casey Reese and Ben Fry, who came up with Processing, if you go to processing.org, you'll see this coding environment and language based on Java for creative coding. And it's pretty easy to learn for designers to learn the basics, and then to get really good at it, it's incredibly hard. But they've made beautiful things, interactive things that are in galleries and museums all over the world. So the idea that you can't be creative with code is, in my opinion, no one can really make that argument. They might be able to, but I'd be interested to hear what the arguments are.
It's interesting. The argument I hear is, well, you can't do two things well. So if I start to learn to be good at code, I'm going to become worse at design. It's such a silly thing, because it's like, yeah, I've never met a designer who was also a really good cook, or a designer who was also a really good musician, right? Because that can't happen in the world. Or, you know, a really good golfer or whatever, right? You can't be good at two things. You can't, you know, or sure you can. You just put in the time. Most of the way you get good at something is you just give yourself the time to practice it. And the fact is, there's a lot of intersection between design and code because it's the medium you're in. Here you are, right? You live in the Netherlands. You live in Amsterdam proper, yes?
About an hour and a half northeast.
Hour and a half northeast. If you go an hour and a half northeast, don't you end up in another country?
No, that'd be, it'd probably be 2.5 hours.
Okay, okay. So an hour and a half to the northeast.
Yeah, I get where you're going. I'd be in Germany if I kept going.
That's right. But, yeah, yeah. Right. So an hour and a half northeast, but there you are, right? You're an American who is now in the Netherlands. And my understanding is that everybody in the Netherlands, or almost everybody in the Netherlands, speaks pretty damn good English.
That's what I thought when I moved here.
Yeah. But the thing is that that's not their natural language, right? Their natural
language. No, it's not true at all. It was really hard to communicate when I first moved here. I moved here with a lot of, I guess, linguistic confidence in that sense. You know, I was really excited because I figured everyone would be able to communicate with me and I with them. And it turned out to be completely wrong. If you're in Amsterdam proper, as you say, which is, you know, a huge tourist attraction, really. Everyone's used to speaking English because it's all tourists, right? But up where I live, it's not like that at all. So, you know, I go and speak English to them and they look at me like I have two heads. You know what I mean?
I remember being in the Amsterdam police station, in one of the police stations in Amsterdam once, and went up to the police officer. I said, "Do you speak English?" And he said, "Do you speak Dutch?" And I said, "No." He says, "Well, then I'll speak English." I won't explain why I was there. But the fact is that...
That's such a Dutch response.
The fact is that that's their language, right? That's what they speak from, you know, their very early age, and that's their thing. And if you really want to communicate well with them, you sort of have to know their language. Now, for you, you know, it's a second language, so you're probably not as fluent in Dutch as people who've lived there the whole time. But having lived there for a while, I'm guessing you speak a pretty darn good passable Dutch.
Yeah, I suppose so, with a heavy American accent.
Right.
Yeah, I write in Dutch, I read Dutch. I don't think in Dutch necessarily, but it was like a priority to me once I realized, and I get where you're going with this, and it's true, that once I realized that people don't communicate as well with me and I can't communicate as well with them as I thought I would, it was a priority to learn the language as well as I could. And the best way to do it, to be honest with you, how I learned it, I took lessons for 2 years, one night a week, to learn Dutch. And I did learn the theoretical aspects of the language that way. But I didn't learn the language really until I just started speaking it, writing it, and reading it at work.
I had a friend who lived in Sweden, and they tried to learn Swedish, and they said that every time they would start to speak to someone in Swedish, the Swedes would pick up their American accent and immediately switch to English. And so it was actually really hard to practice their Swedish because they just thought they were doing her a favor.
Yeah, that does happen. That did happen to me as well for a certain period of time. But you notice that that's kind of a good thing. And if we draw that parallel to like people working together in organizations, you know, teams building web stuff, then that period of people trying to accommodate you because they realize that you don't speak their language yet, that's a good thing. But that shouldn't be a motivation to stop trying to speak their language as well. So once you get to the point where you speak their language, they've done some work to speak your language, you could speak each other's language. So it just depends on the situation. When I go speak at a Dutch event and Dutch people come up to me, I can speak to them in Dutch and the conversation will be in Dutch. But if there's an American speaker who comes along, we know that that's the only person who won't understand what we're talking about, and everyone just starts speaking English. And that makes for a really flexible situation. And that's really the same type of thing that we need to get going in organizations as well, in teams.
Yeah, I think if designers can speak, you know, pidgin developer, you know, they can talk about it in a way that developers understand what they're trying to say, but it's not the clearest, most perfect version of the language. And similarly, developers can talk about design and they understand design and its concept, but they're not going to go out and create the world's greatest designs, but they're going to be able to understand what the designer's trying to do. When you have that situation where everybody can communicate cross-lingually in that way, suddenly it changes the way the team works together.
Absolutely. And you could even take it to more of an extreme and say that the designers who really are interested in learning code can go as far with that as they want without having to worry that they're going to lose their designer identity, because, you know, code doesn't suck the creativity out of you. That creativity, you have it, it's there, and it's not leaving unless you let it lie dormant. So, you know, Val Head, right?
Yeah. I love Val Head. She's so smart.
She is. And I've spoken with her at a couple conferences, and she's given a fantastic talk about animation in web user interfaces and the subtle things you can do with animation to completely enhance your experience, you know, the experience for the people using the thing you're building. And it's so powerful. She gets up there and she just starts typing stuff, you know. And if you don't know code, you're like, what? What is she doing? And then things just start happening on the screen. And it's a beautiful thing to see. And she's also very talented, you know, and everyone's like, I would like to be able to do what she's doing. But aside from that, if you're a designer or if you're an interaction designer, your whole job is to focus on interaction. Wouldn't it be cool if you would be able to play with that kind of thing to get just the type of interaction that you envision.
I saw exactly the same thing a few months ago. I was at a conference and Chris Coyer got up and he completely deconstructed how SVG works. And in the middle of this presentation, he showed a completely responsive icon built out of SVG, because I guess you can build media queries into the SVG code. And so here he was with this SVG house, and as you made the viewport bigger for that SVG item, the house went from this little sort of monopoly-shaped house that was just, you know, a triangle and a square that made a house, to this thing with windows and a door and, you know, trees, and depending on how much space it had. And the power of that and understanding that as a designer, I could change the actual geometry of an icon based on how big the viewport was. But being able to then talk about, well, how do I set the breakpoints in that viewport? And how do I decide at what point should it shift? You know, so if my logo, so the UIE logo has several components. It's got this asterisk, the new one that Dan Rubin created. It has this asterisk. It has the big letters UIE. It has the phrase user interface engineering that's underneath, or sometimes it's to the side. And depending on whether we have more horizontal space than vertical space, we'll put the user interface engineering on the side, or we'll put it at the bottom. Or if we don't have space at all, we'll get rid of user interface engineering and just have UIE. And if it's in its smallest form, it just has an asterisk. So I saw that presentation from Chris Coyer, and I came back, and we have a design intern here. And I said to her, I said, you got to watch this presentation. And then I want you to create a responsive version of our logo. And within 24 hours, she had this really cool responsive version of the logo. And it was because she knew how to code. And it's not hard code. I mean, it's really simple stuff as far as I could tell. She mastered it. I'm sure a production developer would look at it and go, oh my God, that is so big. We got to reduce the size of that by, you know, 70%. But it showed what we were trying to do.
Right. At the same time, it's valid to say, well, it's too much of a jump for me. Let's say I'm a designer who doesn't code at all, and everyone's talking about using code as a design tool, and people get scared by it, understandably. So one of the important things to talk about is how you can gradually get to that point where you can use code as a design tool in addition to your other tools. So I kind of make fun of Photoshop just because it's fun to make fun of. But also Photoshop has the whole idea of working in Photoshop has a whole plethora of problems when it comes to responsive design.
Right. Because you're dealing with fixed pixels and stuff, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the amount of work that has to be done to make changes, for example. So I tend to make fun of Photoshop at times, but I never say, you know, don't use Photoshop and only use code. There are a lot of misconceptions about what you mean when you say use code as a design tool. You know, people think you just go into the browser, open a text editor, and start typing. You know, that's not how design works either. So those are misconceptions. But also, we have to understand that there are some designers who find it very scary. And so we start small. You know, just learn tiny bits of CSS and realize that all this CSS that you're learning, something like color, it's really easy. You type color, a colon, and then the name of a color, right? And then the thing that you attach that to gets that color. That kind of CSS is not very hard, and you kind of have to start there, and there are some tools to get people playing around with it. You could consider them kind of like browser-based sketch tools for CSS, if you will, things like JSBin and CodePen, which is Chris Coyer's
Such
project.
A cool tool. I love
it is a cool
CodePen.
Tool. I love those kind of tools. They allow you to play around with little ideas that you have for the more experienced people.
And he was showing how, I guess, Illustrator will save something as an SVG. So he was showing how you can just take it from Illustrator, plunk it into CodePen, see the code behind it, start tweaking that SVG that Illustrator created, and seeing how that affects the design. And that seems to me to be a great way to learn.
Yes. And, you know, just every browser has some kind of developer tools. They're called developer tools, but they're really design tools as well. So you can open up a website and just start changing things on the fly in the developer tools of your browser. And I know in Chrome, you have a little color picker. So you can just select an element and then pull up the color picker and change the color of the element. It's really easy to change margins and padding and things like that. And if you don't even know CSS, you can play around with these things. It doesn't ruin your website. And you just open up any website and you can see how it's built, and you can also see what effects little changes you make would have on the design at the same time. It's also a great way to learn. It's like, it's a super, super enhanced version of the way we learned how to make websites way back when, which was looking at view source. This is like an interactive view source that you can do anything with. And that's another great way to learn. So you don't have to just go from designing in Photoshop to suddenly making production-ready code. And I don't think anyone reasonable expects that. But to consider code to be like an extra tool in addition to Photoshop and things that you already use, it's a good, healthy way of looking at things, which gives you a lot of options for the future.
Yeah. In your workshop, you're also talking about adaptive content, which is something I hadn't really thought too much about until you and I were talking about how we were putting this workshop together. In addition to understanding code, you sort of have to understand how the content works, right?
Right. Right. So how structured content works, every time you make something, there's a reason for that thing coming into existence. I mean, there's a reason that you want to build a particular website or application or whatever. So when you focus on what is this thing we're building, why are we making it in the first place, it becomes a little bit easier to start thinking about content. The most important thing about content, I guess there are two important things. One is that it should come first, and two is that it should be well-structured. And when I say well-structured, I mean that HTML is a language that's used to add structure to content, to tell machines what a particular piece of content is. For example, this is a heading. This is a paragraph. This is a quote. This is a table or a form or what have you. It's very important to have that, because that basis is going to be the basis of how your thing shows up in any device that you can imagine. Any device that can go onto the internet and read web pages can read plain HTML. So that's why structure is so important in that content. It's also because we know what these pieces are. And we also have to know how these pieces fit together, what's most important, what's not as important, but in the context of a linear format. So let's say you were just writing a book. You have chapters, and within the chapters, you might have subchapters and things like that. So it's good to think about this kind of thing. And everything has content. Every single interface has some kind of content. Even if it's just icons, which I hate, you know, I dislike, like, for example, the iOS interface. I can't get myself to like those icon-based interfaces. That's a personal preference. But even if you have icons, there's still content. You know, it might be implied content, unless they've done it accessibly, but it's always got content. So what is that content? It should hopefully be completely relevant to the reason that you're making this thing in the first place, but it should be the starting point of every project. And I did a project about a year and a half ago, went into a large company, and I walked in, and within the first 2 minutes I was there, the project manager came up to me with the content manager. They have this content department, has like 100 content managers, if you will.
Are they on the same floor with the developers, or are they in like...
No, they're in a different building.
In a different building, yeah, okay. Yes.
They have a building especially for the content people.
Does it have special loading docks to load the content in and out?
Yeah,
I got meta on you, sorry.
Yeah, you did. It made me think of a newsroom in a way for some reason.
Oh, interesting. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, so they're kind of all in rows, I guess, but they're all working on different content for different projects that they're working on, different websites and different products. But there's one person who's kind of in charge of this particular project as far as content goes. And so she was there, and the project manager was there, and he had this huge spreadsheet. It was like A3 pieces of paper all taped onto each other. So I guess like four A3 sheets landscape taped together. So it was huge, took up a huge table. And he's like, "This is our whole plan. What do you think of it?" So I had the advantage of being someone external that they hired to come and help them with this project. So even things that people have been saying for a year in that organization and no one hears them, I could say the exact same thing and they would listen to me, right? That's the advantage of being external. So he said, tell me what you think of the spreadsheet. We're starting here with interaction design, and then we've got visual design, we've got this, we've got that, we've got development, and we've got content. And content was literally the end, okay, like it is on most projects. And he said, you could say anything you want, and we'll do it. I was like, okay, take that column of content and move it all the way to the very beginning. And that was it. And that one thing made a huge difference. It was completely different than any other project that they had worked on just because they did the content first. What that ended up being is the content people had less work to do because they only had to worry about the content that they really needed to worry about, and they didn't have to fill in the blanks of some kind of design where the designers kind of came up with things that might need content, you know what I mean? That might not necessarily even be important. The designers could design something based on the content, right? So it fit the content really well. And there was a little bit of back and forth there as well. And the developers were involved from the very beginning, which meant that they knew exactly what was going to be done. And they could start playing around from the start. Even though they didn't know from the very beginning exactly what things would look like, they kind of knew what the idea was. And they kept having these meetings, you know, all the time. It was almost like an agile type of process. And by the time the comps were done, really there wasn't a whole lot more to be done to get the thing live. You know what I mean? It was a fantastic process. They saved about, I guess, like 700 or 800 hours compared to what the developers had estimated they would need. And that's a lot of money for them. It's just a huge amount of money. And I think they had between 20 and 25% conversion on this. It was mobile specific, this project, but they had like 20 to 25% conversion in 1 week. So it was a little over a week. So that was just an incredible success story for the owner of that project. He was like the king in that organization for a while. So, but it's just an example of what happens when you simply move content to the very beginning of your process. That was the thing.
Well, that's cool. So in your workshop, you're going to show people how to do just that, to move it to the beginning, how to then build a workflow around that, and even show them that, you know, they don't need to be scared of just a little bit of code just to pull this off, right?
No, and developers don't need to be scared of a little bit of sketching. We're going to do some of that as well.
When they come to the workshop, they should bring their developer with them.
That would be the way to do it. Yeah, that would be fantastic. It would be great to have a developer, a content strategist or a content manager, the visual designer, and an interaction designer. And you know what? Bring the client, because that's part of the thing too, is having your client involved throughout the process, which avoids the problems that you have when you go away for 3 weeks and do what Mark Bolton calls the big reveal, where you come back and you show these beautiful Photoshop comps and the client's like, well, it's not totally what I expected. And then you have to go back and do all those changes.
Can you make the logo bigger?
Yeah. And then make that bigger in the desktop Photoshop comp and do that in the mobile smartphone Photoshop comp. And again, in the tablet Photoshop comp. And then that for every single comp that you've made. So, you know, want to avoid that kind of thing.
And Bob from accounting wants this language changed.
Yes, exactly. It actually happens that way, you know. I literally had to change the font size of headings in a design where we had like upwards of 20 comps. And so, you know, in Photoshop, you go in, you select the headings. I tell this story all the time, but you select the heading, you make it bigger. But, you know, a designer doesn't just go in and select a heading and make it bigger and then call it a day. That affects all the space around the heading, you know, so they have to move other things around as well. And eventually you have to make the document larger just because things have pushed down so much, you know what I mean? And then you get to go and do that for, you know, 20 other comps. So, and that's one change. And then the next day they have another change because John from marketing was on vacation, just got back today, you know?
Yes, that's right. That's right. He's looking at this for the first time and wondering why we're doing it that way.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hey, Stephen, this was awesome. I'm really excited about your workshop, and we're going to learn so much. It's going to be fabulous.
Looking forward to it.
Excellent. So if you are interested in coming to the workshop and bringing your developer and your content person and your interaction designer, in fact, we will give away an award for the person who brings the biggest team with them. You can do that. You can go to uxim.co and look for Stephen's full day workshop, which is called Optimizing Responsive Workflows with Structured Content, and you will not be disappointed. It's going to be a fabulous day, and you're going to come out of there knowing exactly what you need to do to get your workflow producing really great designs and the content working with the design so effectively. It's going to be so much fun. Stephen, thanks for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you.
And I want to thank our audience for listening. And as always, thank you for encouraging our behavior. We'll talk to you again next time. Take care.
For more information about Stephen's and the other five workshops, visit uxim.co. That's uxim.co. As always, thanks for listening.